Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, March 17th, 2024, St. Paddy's Day. I'll begin with the featured story in the magazine this week. My golden doodle spent a week at some luxury dog hotels. I tagged along. How exactly did dogs take over our world? This writer journeys into the bespoke pet care industry to find out. There's a picture accompanying it. Shows the author lying down on the ground in a sleeping bag, and there's a pillow there, and his golden doodle is sitting in a little puppy bed. He says, the author and his golden doodle, Steve, in the Annapolis suite at the Holiday Barn Pet Resorts outside Richmond, Virginia. This article is by Sam Apple. By the time my golden doodle, Steve, and I pulled up to our resting place, I was tired from the long drive and already second-guessing my plan. I felt a little better when we stepped inside the Dogwood Acres Pet Retreat. The lobby with its elegant tiled entrance might have passed for the lobby of any small countryside hotel, at least one that strongly favored dog-themed decor. But this illusion was broken when the receptionist reviewed our reservation, which, in addition to our luxury suite, included cuddle time, group play, a nature walk, and a belly rub tuck-in. Venues like this one, located on Kent Island in Maryland's Chesapeake Bay, didn't exist when I was growing up in the 80s. If you needed a place to board your dog back then, you went to a kennel where the dog spent virtually the entire day in a small and probably not very clean cage. There were no tuck-ins, no bedtime stories, no dog bone-shaped swimming pools. There was certainly nothing like today's most upscale canine resorts, where the dogs sleep on queen-sized beds and the spa offerings include mud baths and blueberry facials. One pet hotel franchise on the West Coast will even pick up your dog in a Lamborghini. I knew Dogwood Acres wouldn't be quite as luxurious as that, but the accommodation still sounded pretty nice. The website mentioned distinctive decor, cable television, and a large picture window overlooking an extra-large private outdoor patio. There's a picture. It says Steve at the Old Town Spa, where his treatments included a mud bath, a blueberry facial, and a spritz of dog cologne. It's a close-up of Steve being bathed. My plan was to stay with Steve at a string of dog hotels. Yes, for dogs only, in the mid-Atlantic region, not too far from where I live. Putting the plan into action had required making a series of deeply embarrassing phone calls. My requests were sometimes met with awkward silences, which would be followed by questions along the lines of, "You sure you want to do that?" I tried to explain that staying at dog hotels would take me to the heart of some questions that I'd been thinking about a lot in recent months. How did humans start catering to the whims of canines rather than the other way around? And what if, somewhere along the way, we all became a little too obsessed with our dogs? After Steve was weighed and examined for fleas and ticks, we were escorted to our room. Everyone at Dogwood Acres was exceptionally warm and welcoming, which did nothing to lessen my fear as I walked by them clutching my sleeping bag and rolling suitcase that they all thought was a total schmuck. I wanted to take each employee aside and explain that it wasn't what it seemed, that I was actually on a very serious quest to understand something important. about the American condition in the 21st century. But there was nothing to be done because, of course, the only thing schmuckier than staying at a facility for dogs is trying to justify it as a quest to understand something important about the American condition in the 21st century. And there's another picture, and it shows the author and Steve arriving at Dogwood Acres, a hotel for dogs on Kent Island, Chesapeake Bay. There's lots of windows, and he's smiling and carrying all his stuff, with Steve following behind. I tried to remain positive as Steve and I made our way into the recesses of Dogwood Acres. Never mind if the hallway of luxury suites had less the feel of the Ritz-Carlton than of, say, a Soviet-era Bulgarian office building. So what if the room directly across from our suite was occupied by a large black dog named Bella, who was barking ferociously and lunging at the window facing our room? What difference did it make that someone had used a black marker to add some all-caps notes to the printed card taped to Bella's door? Do not reach for head. Caution with sudden movements. Did it really matter that our room was significantly smaller than I anticipated, 6.5 feet by 6.5 feet, or that the extra-large private outdoor patio was surrounded by steel caging? Could have been worse. I had my sleeping bag. There was a TV and an elegant stainless steel pail of water, should Steve or I get thirsty. It was all, of course, entirely my own fault. Audrey Reichart, the owner, had graciously offered to set up a cot and air mattress for me, but I insisted I wanted only what the dogs get. "This is it," Reichart said, extending her hand to the room. "But you're not a dog." A little while later, a young woman came by to give Steve his bedtime belly rub tuck-in. Watching by the open door, I couldn't help thinking that if only humans were good and innocent like dogs, instead of being so weird and gross and sex-obsessed, we might have a wider range of wholesome services like this one available at our hotels. Then I remembered that Steve might not be so good and pure around his own kind either, had I not had his testicles surgically removed. At 8 p.m., it was lights out. Steve got onto his dog cot with the stuffed mallard toy I'd packed. A few minutes later, I heard some deep breathing and saw that Steve was out cold, which made the whole experience lonelier, like when a friend would fall asleep first at a sleepover. At some point, I remembered that I hadn't eaten all day. I took a few hard-boiled eggs out of my bag and looked through the window to the patio steel cage and felt it really should have been impossible, even smuckier than before. It's not just the hotels. There are now dog bakeries, ice cream parlors, and social clubs. One dog-only San Francisco cafe serves canines a $75 tasting menu. More and more restaurants for people also now offer dog menus. A lot of these things probably started as jokes, but such gestures have a way of outliving their origins. At some point, throwing birthday parties for our dogs and buying them Valentine's Day gifts went from being something we did to be funny to something we just did. Total spending on pets in the United States, and dogs are by far the most popular pet, rose more than 50% between 2018 and 2022, when it reached $137 billion, according to a Pet Products Trade Association. $137 billion a year. Americans now spend more than $500 million each year on pet Halloween costumes alone, per the National Retail Federation. This sharp spending increase overlaps with Americans spending approximately twice as much time with pets today as they did two decades ago. A 2023 survey found that Around half of American owners believe their pet knows them better than anyone else does, including significant others and best friends. These statistics sit uncomfortably alongside the fact that the U.S. Surgeon General recently declared loneliness an epidemic. It's hard not to wonder whether our growing obsession with dogs is somehow related to our declining interest in one another. Maybe, even as we're humanizing our dogs, the deeper appeal is not that they're like people, but that they're not like people. Maybe if you dig far enough beneath the surface of our dog love, you eventually arrive at a thin layer of misanthropy. My interest in America's dog mania wasn't only sociological. Several months before our trip, I found a small lump on Steve's right hind leg. The tumor turned out to be benign, but the experience left me profoundly shaken. When the veterinary surgeon told me she thought it was cancer, I had to sit in the car for 10 minutes to regain my composure before driving home. Every time I looked over and saw Steve's breathtakingly goofy face encircled by his dumb plastic cone, I started to cry again. Before this cancer scare, I probably would have said that the expanding place of dogs in American life was a good thing, that a world that revolves around dogs is a better world. It was only after I realized how unready I was to lose Steve that I found myself wondering if the problem with our current dog mania might run deeper than I'd thought. I don't think of myself as particularly lonely, but I don't get together with friends in person very often anymore. The phone calls I used to have with friends have been replaced by texts. I usually work from home, and on a typical work day, I interact with many more people on Zoom than in real life. If I need the comfort of another beating heart, the closest one around is inside Steve's rib cage. Unfortunately, if less human connection is driving us to form deeper bonds with our dogs, it's hard to conclude that dogs are actually solving our problems. The most surprising finding in the field of anthrozoology, which studies human-animal relationships, might be that there's no conclusive link between pets and well-being. In 2021, Megan Mueller at Tufts University discovered that pet owners were twice as likely to report being depressed as those without pets. That finding was only an association. We can't really say whether pets are responsible for that depression or if depressed people are simply more likely to have pets. Still, the mismatch between our personal experience with the animals that we love and what the research says is a complete mystery. Hal Herzog, an anthrozoologist and emeritus professor at Western Carolina University, told me. Most studies don't show that pet owners are happier, that pet owners are less depressed, that pet owners go to the doctors less. The next morning at Dogwood Acres, the staff threw a birthday party for Steve in a gated yard. Steve's birthday was less than 2 months away, so I told myself the request was legit. A dozen dogs ran around happily in a sea of toys. There was a bubble machine and a tub full of colorful plastic balls. Steve, decked out in a handsome birthday boy bandana, immediately picked up a stuffed bone, and because I know there's nothing he loves more than making a complete mockery of me in a game of chase, I ran after him. There's a picture under there. Steve sporting his birthday boy bandana at Dogwood Acres. And there's six employees around, all wearing birthday hats. And there's a cute happy birthday banner on the wall. And all the letters are shaped like dogs. And it shows the author filming it on his phone. And there's another picture that shows everybody with two of the staff with these multicolored balls in a tub. And they're throwing them around, and there's about six dogs chasing them around. It's all on fake green grass. Our next stop was a presidential suite at Holiday Barn Pet Resorts just outside Richmond, Virginia. Each Holiday Barn suite had a different regional theme. Ours was Annapolis, and the suite's orange and white walls featured tasteful maritime decor, including a little blue shelf holding an antique beer stein and tiny pitchers. It was so nice, 7.5 feet by 8 feet, that I didn't care at all that Hartley, the golden retriever staying down the hall, had the considerably fancier Mount Vernon suite, which featured a painting of George Washington and a tubular light fixture that called to mind Dan Flavin. This business, which has been family-run since it opened in Glen Allen, Virginia in 1972, was originally called Holiday Barn Pet Kennel, and the dogs stayed in cages attached to outdoor kennel runs. You had vermin coming in, the resort owner Michael Hughes recalled. All of a sudden you look and there's a raccoon in there, or a possum, or a snake. Not long after it opened, Hughes's parents began hiring teenage petters. At the time, tending to the emotional needs of a dog in a kennel was considered novel. Today, dog boarding establishments have to focus most on the emotional needs of pet parents, as owners are known in the industry. Hughes mentioned a Holiday Barn guest that ate only Chick-fil-A sandwiches. Some dog hotels, suites have cameras, and emails from concerned owners arrive throughout the night. San Francisco's Pet Camp once received a frantic call from a woman who wanted to know why her dog had come home with an erection. The hoteliers denied responsibility for the erection. A dog hotel in Pennsylvania once had to make time for a pet parent who insisted on calling in each day to play the kazoo to her dog. Pet parents is a term of modern creation, although pet has a longer history. The word first came into use in the early 1500s, and from the beginning it could refer not only to animals, but also to people, particularly spoiled children. James Serple, an emeritus professor of animal welfare at the University of Pennsylvania, told me that the origin of humans keeping pets can probably be traced to the human tendency to respond to young animals in the same way we respond to small children. It's an extension of our parenting instincts. We have extended our parenting instincts so far, it seems, that the distinction between pets and children has evaporated altogether. And pet industry experts say the relentless humanizing of our dogs has been accelerated by millennials and Gen Z, who now make up the largest share of dog owners in the country and who often have a first dog before a first child. Americans in their 20s and 30s nowadays have a lot of spare parental love in their hearts, and their dogs are lapping it up. I slept well at Holiday Barn. The next morning before leaving, I helped Steve into a dog life jacket so he could splash around in the bone-shaped pool. I put on some rubber boots and clomped around after him while two chocolate labs took turns swimming laps. Previous few days were overcast, but the sun was out now and I was overcome with, and I could really get used to this feeling before I realized I was now fantasizing about extending my stay at a dog resort. I knew before I arrived that the Old Town Pet Resort in Dulles, Virginia, where Steve and I would be spending the last night of our trip, would be the fanciest of our destinations. But I was wowed just the same. The lobby had a sculpture of a pointer and a glass wall with a view of the heated indoor pool. It was nicer than the lobby of most human hotels I'd stayed in. When I later interviewed Ron Halligan, president and chief executive of Old Town Pet Resorts, he told me his job came from with some special challenges. It's like running an acute care retirement facility. They all have to be taken to the bathroom. We have a med cart. half of them are on meds. After we checked in, a friendly young man named Jonathan Neal led Steve through an agility session, during which Steve jumped through hoops and walked along ramps and elevated planks. Neal then changed into a wetsuit to oversee Steve's swimming session, which involved leading a very unamused Steve back and forth across the 20-foot-long pool. Though I'd arranged to stay at a luxury suite at Old Town, there was a concern that the dogs there might smell me, and this could be upsetting to them. So Steve and I were put up in an otherwise unoccupied wing, comprising essentially large roofless cages. It's probably for the best. I wasn't particularly in the mood to watch Happy Feet, which was playing on the TVs in the suites that night. A cot had been set up for me, and I was too tired to refuse it. It was hardly big enough for a person, but Steve, foregoing his own dog-sized cot, climbed up with me. Then William Tyler, the executive director of the hotel at the time, stopped by our cage. Tyler, a middle-aged former Marine and a good-sized man, got down on the floor inches away from us and began to read Steve his bedtime story, a book about Clifford the Big Red Dog saving people from a fire. When Tyler finished reading, he said goodnight to us and turned out the lights. I curled around Steve as best I could on the cot, feeling grateful that he was there with me. But I wondered about Steve's feelings, too. Over the course of my time living in the lap of canine luxury, I became more convinced than ever that a world with more dog love is a better world. Yet I also met quite a few human beings in the bespoke pet care industry who, having observed all parties up close, expressed their anxieties about the extent of our devotion. When humans include animals in everything they do, the dog doesn't know how to be a dog, Hughes had told me. Lying there on this last night, I wish Steve could tell me what he'd thought of the whole thing. In the morning, Steve got a mud bath at Old Town Spa and a blueberry facial, and then after Steve was blown out and brushed and sprayed with a dog cologne, it was time to drive home. It had been a good trip. As we drove back, I stroked Steve's head at red lights and felt only a little bit like a schmuck. Sam Apple, the author, teaches in the science, writing, and writing master's programs at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Ravenous, Otto Warburg, the Nazis, and the Search for the Cancer Diet Connection. Holly Andrews, who took all the photos, is a photographer in Portland, Oregon. She's photographed numerous subjects for the magazine, including Tom Sandoval, open marriages, and young climate activists. Now I'll read another dog-related story. Dog TV is TV for dogs, except when it's for people. The channel hopes to tap into a huge new audience of pandemic puppies, but also make sure to try to appeal to viewers who can actually operate a remote. This is a story by Austin Considine. The talent was beginning to lie down on the job. Temperatures had surpassed 90 degrees on a July afternoon at Ramapo Mountain State Forest in northern New Jersey, and the actors were hot and literally panting. If they had to perform much longer, the director might face a mutiny. The director, Ron Levi, threw up his hands. "Tell them union is 8 hours work," he called out. "What do you mean they're done?" A horror story overheard at a recent SAG-AFTRA rally? Not exactly. The director, for starters, was joking. As for the actors, they didn't get the joke anyway. The stars, Beasley, Darby, Fuji, and Whidbey, are among the four-legged leads on Dog TV, a pay television service designed especially for dogs who are stuck at home alone. In the coming weeks, the Ramapo footage would be recolored, edited, and scored for its colorblind, easily distracted, and narratively challenged viewers, optimized, the makers of Dog TV say, to engage and soothe a growing audience of bored and anxious dogs around the world. It wasn't your typical set visit, but then that's also why I was there, to see, as my boss had phrased it, how the snossage is made for a network whose primary audience can't operate a remote. One thing I was learning was that when you have a canine cast, they, not the crew, not the guild, ultimately call the shots. Everyone agreed to call it a wrap. These dogs are the best we ever worked with, and they can deliver you the goods, Levi, who is also a founder of Dog TV, said as the dogs were led by their trainer, Chrissy Joy, back to their air-conditioned van for fresh water and presumably some well-earned belly scratches. But I get it, Levi added. It's very hot today, and we've got to be mindful. These are boom times for Dog TV. During the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, some 23 million households adopted pets, according to a 2021 survey by the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, a huge new potential audience to target. Americans working from home were also watching a lot of TV, often, apparently, with their pets. In response, Dog TV began offering a bunch of new human-targeted videos, notably featuring tips from experts on how to train all of these new pets. Subscriptions to its streaming app has grown by about 388,000 since mid-2020, the company said. Dog TV is also available through many cable and satellite providers. People were at home and started to ask us about content for them as well, Levi said. It's like, okay, you got a new dog, what do you do with it? Now Dog TV is hoping to fill a new role as more workers return to the office and their new dogs, many of whom have never known life without a human at home full time, are dealing with intense separation anxiety. The network is producing content custom made for such anxiety among dogs and increasingly their guilt-ridden humans. Full disclosure, I am one of those guilt-ridden humans. I became a Dog TV subscriber first around 2013 as the single dog father of my beloved mutt, Sailor. A few years later, after Sailor departed for that great dog park in the sky, I canceled my subscription. When in 2021, my partner and I got a new rescue puppy named Evie, I resubscribed only to find that Dog TV had grown by leaps and bounds. Sometimes I would come home tired from work only to realize that I had just been zoning out to Dog TV on the couch for 20 minutes. The basic concept was the same, short, simple videos, mostly for dogs, but the creativity and production values had exploded. I wanted to know more about this world I unexpectedly found myself enjoying, even if I had to take it on faith that my blasé new shelter dog was enjoying it too. That's when I reached out to Levi. Dog TV relies on teams of directors, camera operators, composers, editors, and dogs. But if Dog TV has a single mad wizard behind the curtain, it's Levi. Before Dog TV, he worked in human TV in Israel, including as a writer for that country's version of The Amazing Race. He doesn't miss it. This is totally better, because the dog is really the director, he told me. He teaches you also to be a little bit modest. During an editing session at a Manhattan studio in August, Levi, who's also the chief content officer, acknowledged tailoring the content in recent years to appeal to more humans. That wasn't true of just the new Tips and Tricks video or of reality shows like Farm Girl, starring Joy and her dogs. Just as a good children's show must be semi-tolerable, if not enjoyable, to adults, TV for dogs must bow to a simple truth. The primary viewers aren't the ones who shell out $9.99 a month. Given this, Levi's ideal balance is for videos that appeal 80% to dogs and 20% to humans. The squeaky toy sound effects are for dogs. The shoots in Sicily, that stuff is for humans. 100% dog could mean showing a dog for 10 minutes, for 5 minutes because of the attention span, running from left to right with this white background, he added. They don't care if it's a beautiful location in California. But as the paying human, I indeed cared. I was drawn in by the visuals, which had become rather arty and sometimes downright weird, as when I watched a puppy in one video waddle through space. Several videos featured sinewy swirls of color set to a synthy space-age score. Another had a dog placed digitally on a train, grinning as alpine mountains and crystal waters scrolled by through the window. The music was often great, electronic, atmospheric, like a mix of Tangerine Dream and Tim Hector. Ryan Wasoba, a producer based near St. Louis, who has scored music for dog TV for a decade, acknowledged that he and his dog Olivia had been listening to a lot of Brian Eno when he first began composing for the channel. Other times, the channel's music is more like the theme to Romper Room. When it comes to the channel's two-legged fans, I'm apparently not alone. The actor Billy Bob Thornton described watching dog TV with his daughter and two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels as kind of a zen moment during a 2016 appearance on Live with Kelly. And although I've never watched while partaking in certain forms of herbaceous relaxation, there is ample evidence on social media indicating that some dog TV subscribers do have some herbaceous relaxation. Jay Gualiardo, a subscriber from Rochester, New York, said that he and his wife Sylvia had adopted two dogs, Benny and Penny, during shutdown. It wasn't always clear who in the house liked dog TV the most. Sylvia will come home from work and I'll be sitting on the couch staring at freaking dog TV and she'll be like, "What are you doing?" he said, laughing. And I'm like, "Well, you got to see this. They're going through the fields and the ducks are following them." And she's like, "Oh my God, dude, go back to work." Who was dog TV really for anyway? Shows a strange picture underneath that of a dog. And it looks like the dog is reading TV guide, but as human hands holding it in front of the TV guide, there's a bagel, cereal, and a coffee cup. You can see behind, they're in the kitchen, and there's all sorts of pictures on a refrigerator. The dog is definitely smiling. To answer that question was partly to consider whether the dogs get much out of it. Gragliardo said dog TV had helped his dogs considerably when he began leaving them home alone for the first time since the pandemic as he resumed in-person meetings. He could tell, he said, because he often comes home to a present on the floor if he accidentally leaves them home without it. Kate Senkier of Nashville said her two dogs, Piper and Puddles, the latter of whom she got immediately after the pandemic, started off as devoted Gilmore Girl fans before they discovered dog TV. Now, whenever she goes upstairs to work, she said, they sit on the couch and look at me and wait for me to turn the TV on. I've watched Evie watch dog TV, and sometimes she seems to care. Usually I can't tell. In a study commissioned by dog TV, Nicholas Dodman, a professor emeritus of animal behavior at Tufts University near Boston, found that dogs visibly watch dog TV about 14% of the time it was on. That was more than they watched Animal Planet, and significantly more than they did CNN. Luckily, dogs aren't the ones who pay for journalism either. But CNN provided perhaps the best analogy for the way Dodman thought dogs might experience dog TV. In general, dogs understand their world primarily by smell, then sound, then by sight. It isn't clear how much dogs merely listen to dog TV, Dodman said, but it stands to reason that they do, just as humans will listen to TV in the background. If we had CNN on while we're cooking breakfast, you know, you're busy with the frying pan and stuff, and then someone says, there's going to be an earthquake, he said, you might suddenly look up and pay attention. Dogs, he reasoned, might be doing the same. Maybe they're always half listening. That made abundant sense. I just wasn't sure what it said about humans like me and Billy Bob Thornton, who become so fully absorbed. Austin Considine is the Times assistant TV editor. It's interesting. There's not one article that's related to St. Patrick's Day. I'll read a letter of recommendation. I used to cringe at self-help books until this one changed my life. How a best-selling classic from 1992 helped me rediscover my creativity. It's an article by Jillian Steinhauer. And they have a picture of this book, The Artist's Way, A Spiritual Path to Higher Creativity. I've written about art my whole career. I find it and its creators endlessly fascinating. But I've always seen myself as something of a different kind, a journalist and critic, yes, but never an artist, with all the imaginative power that word conveys. Recently, though, I conducted a particularly poignant, intimate interview. The artist and I talked about childhood and the struggle of making oneself heard. There were tears. Afterward, I had a thought. What would it be like if I were the one being interviewed? Could I be the artist possessed of creative vision like one of my subjects? The prospect was equally thrilling and terrifying. These questions grew out of a long period in which I'd been feeling alternately adrift and stuck. I regularly write about contemporary art for publications like this one, but for a while, I've been in creative limbo. At first, I wasn't sure why or even how to describe it. Sometimes I said I felt disconnected from my voice. Other times, that my work and life, which was then filled with death and illness, seemed to have grown far apart. I tried to address this through my usual methods, talking to friends, family, my therapist. When those didn't work, I turned to a remedy several people had suggested, the 1992 book The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. Structured as a 12-week course that leads the reader on a spiritual journey of creative recovery, the book begins as a class and a collection of typed-up pages that Cameron photocopied and sold in bookstores until she found a publisher willing to take it on. We didn't know where to put it on the shelves, Joel Fotinos, who published the book at Penguin, said in a 2019 interview. Usually, there was a category called creativity, and The Artist's Way launched it. The book has sold more than 5 million copies since its publication, and Cameron has become kind of a guru. I knew none of this when I ordered The Artist's Way, only that it was some kind of woo-woo self-help book that had popularized the phrase morning pages, which seemed like journaling in the morning. When I sat down to read, I almost immediately cringed. On the first page of the introduction, Cameron invokes the great creator, also known as capital G God. That immediately set off my internal alarm. I underlined it wavily and wrote, alongside. Turning the page, I realized to my horror that random inspirational quotes set in the margins were going to be a recurring theme. An example, I shut my eyes in order to see, credited to Paul Gauguin. The following chapters brought a bewildering jumble of metaphors. I like to think I'm receptive, but I am also a critic, someone who prides herself on her discerning taste, at least in certain realms, including books. This was like a compendium of questionable taste. It took me back to the days of being a preteen when I pored over the Chicken Soup for the Soul series and published my bad poetry in school magazines. That version of me was so earnest that in retrospect I found her a bit embarrassing. But I also envied her nerve. She seemed a lot less self-conscious than the person I'd become. As it turned out, the beauty of the artist's way was in asking people like me to set aside matters of taste entirely. Instead, Cameron prompted me to turn inward. One of her two core practices is the morning pages, writing three longhand pages upon waking up, which Cameron says gets us to the other side of our fear, of our negativity, of our moods, by creating space to contend with them. The other is the artist date, a weekly solo excursion or activity meant to cultivate inspiration. I didn't always manage to do these tasks, but I recognized their value. I had arranged to do the artist's way with a small group of women, and as one of them put it in a meeting, the exercises offered a way of witnessing ourselves. Cameron's writing encouraged that exploration. She spoke plainly and directly, without elaborate flourishes and conspicuous erudition. I came to appreciate the book's many flaws. There was something refreshing about a text that didn't need to be perfect, that came from a place of urgency. She said what needed to be said, and when she did, I often felt as if she were seeing and dragging me simultaneously. Most blocked creatives have an active addiction to anxiety, she wrote. We prefer the low-grade pain and occasional heart-stopping panic attack to the drudgery of small and simple daily steps in the right direction. My God, I responded in the margins. Cameron seemed at home in her voice. Her tutelage made me think about mine. I realized that after 17 years as a journalist and critic, the balance was off. I had allowed my professional taste-making, an inherently public concern, to obscure other interests and curiosities. I had honed my professional voice at the expense of my private one. Loving the artist's way feels strangely embarrassing because it's less rational than it is sincere. But as Cameron knows, authenticity is the best place for an artist to begin. Julian Steinauer is a critic and reporter who covers the politics of art and comics. She won a 2019 Andy Warhol Foundation Arts Writers Grant and was previously a senior editor at Hyperallegoric. More about Julian Steinauer at another time. I'll read another featured article, What Deathbed Visions Teach Us About Living. Researchers are documenting a phenomenon that seems to help the dying as well as those they leave behind. This is a story by Phoebe Zerwick. Chris Kerr was 12 when he first observed a deathbed vision. His memory of that summer in 74 is blurred, but not the sense of mystery he felt at the bedside of his dying father. Throughout Kerr's childhood in Toronto, his father, a surgeon, was too busy to spend much time with his son, except for an annual fishing trip they took, just the two of them, to the Canadian wilderness. Gaunt and weakened by cancer at 42, his father reached for the buttons on Kerr's shirt, fiddled with them, and said something about getting ready to catch the plane to their cabin in the woods. I knew wherever he was must be a good place because we were going fishing, Kerr told me. As he moved to touch his father, Kerr felt a hand on his shoulder. A priest had followed him into the hospital room and was now leading him away, telling him his father was delusional. Kerr's father died early the next morning. Kerr now calls what he witnessed an end-of-life vision. His father wasn't delusional, he believes. His mind was taking him to a place and time where he and his son could be together in the wilds of northern Canada. And the priest, he feels, made a mistake, one that many other caregivers make, of dismissing the moment as a break with reality, as something from which the boy required protection. It would be more than 40 years before Kerr felt compelled to speak about that evening in the hospital room. He had followed his father and three generations before him into medicine and was working at Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo, where he was the chief medical officer and conducted research on end-of-life visions. It wasn't until he gave a TEDx talk in 2015 that he shared the story of his father's death. Pacing the stage in the sport coat he always wears, he told the audience, "My point here is, I didn't choose this topic of dying. I felt it has chosen or followed me." He went on, "When I was present at the bedside of the dying, I was confronted by what I had seen and tried so hard to forget from my childhood. I saw dying patients reaching and calling out to mothers and to fathers and to children, many of whom hadn't been seen for many years. But what was remarkable was so many of them looked at peace." The talk received millions of views and thousands of comments, many from nurses grateful that someone in the medical field validated what they had long understood. Others, too, posted personal stories of having witnessed loved ones' visions in their final days. For them, Kerr's message was kind of a confirmation of something they instinctively knew, that deathbed visions are real, can provide comfort, even heal past trauma, that they can, in some cases, feel transcendent, that our minds are capable of conjuring images that help us, at the end, make sense of our lives. Nothing in Kerr's medical training prepared him for his first shift at Hospice Buffalo one Saturday morning in the spring of 1999. He had earned a degree from the Medical College of Ohio while working on a PhD in neurobiology. After a residency in internal medicine, Kerr started a fellowship in cardiology in Buffalo. To earn extra money to support his wife and two young daughters, he took a part-time job with Hospice Buffalo. Till then, Kerr had worked in the conventional medical system, focused on patients who were often tethered to machines or heavily medicated. If they recounted visions, he had no time to listen. But in the quiet of Hospice, Kerr found himself in the presence of something he hadn't seen since his father's death, patients who spoke of people and places visible only to them. So just like my father, there's just this feeling of reverence, of something that wasn't understood, but certainly felt, he says. During one of his shifts, Kerr was checking on a 70-year-old woman named Mary, whose grown children had gathered in her room drinking wine to lighten the mood. Without warning, Kerr remembers, Mary sat up in her bed, crossed her arms at her chest. "Danny," she cooed, kissing and cuddling a baby only she could see. At first her children were confused. There was no Danny in the family, no baby in their mother's arms. But they could sense that whatever their mother was experiencing brought her a sense of calm. Kerr later learned that long before her four children were born, Mary lost a baby in childbirth. She never spoke of it with her children, but now she was, through a vision, seemingly addressing that loss. In observing Mary's final days at hospice, Kerr found his calling. "I was disillusioned by the assembly line nature of medicine," Kerr told me. This felt like a more humane and dignified model of care. He quit cardiology to work full-time at the bedsides of dying patients. Many of them described visions that drew from their lives and seemed to hold meaning. unlike hallucinations resulting from medication or delusional, incoherent thinking, which can also occur at the end of life. But Kerr couldn't persuade other doctors, even young residents making the rounds with him at hospice, of their value. They wanted scientific proof. At the time, only a handful of published medical studies had documented deathbed visions, and they largely relied on secondhand reports from doctors and other caregivers rather than accounts from patients themselves. On a flight home from a conference, Kerr outlined a study of his own, and in 2010, a research fellow, Ann Banas, signed on to conduct it with him. Like Kerr, Banas had a family member who, before his death, experienced visions. A grandfather who imagined himself in a train station with his brothers. The study wasn't designed to answer how these visions differ neurologically from hallucinations or delusions. Rather, Kerr saw his role as chronicler of his patients' experiences. Borrowing from social science research methods, Kerr, Banas, and their colleagues based their study on daily interviews with patients in the 22-bed inpatient unit at the hospice campus in the hope of capturing the frequency and varied subject matter of their visions. Patients were screened to ensure that they were lucid, not in a confused or delirious state. The research, published in 2014 in the Journal of Palliative Medicine, found that visions are far more common and frequent than other researchers had found, with an astonishing 88% of patients reporting at least one vision. Later studies in Japan, India, Sweden, and Australia confirmed that visions are common. The percentages ranged from about 20 to 80%, though a majority of these studies rely on interviews with caregivers and not patients. Sorry, but I'm going to have to finish this story next week. And I'll end today with Judge John Hodgman on the Lake Michigan Truther. His wife finds it offensive that he says it should always be considered part of Lake Huron. Carolyn writes, "My husband insists that Lake Michigan and Lake Huron are the same lake and that it should be called Lake Huron. I find this offensive. I love Lake Michigan. I grew up nearby and spent many glorious summer days at the beach. Please, order him to drop this and admit that Lake Michigan exists." And the judge writes, "As I'm sure your husband has explained often and boringly, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan are indeed one big lake, hydrologically speaking, as they share their waters back and forth through the Straits of Mackinac. This is a nice shiny penny's worth of fact that he can enjoy turning over in his mind and or show off at dinner parties in order to repel conversation. But he should stop saying it to you. Hydrology is no reason to erase the long and distinct history of the peoples of Lake Michigan, you included. In every useful context, it's a real lake, and he should go jump in it." John Hodgman is also the host of the Judge John Hodgman podcast, and the theme of his writing and podcast is Judge John Hodgman. He doesn't offer advice. He delivers judgment. I messed that up. Judge John Hodgman, he doesn't offer advice. He delivers justice. Thank you for joining us for the Sunday magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.